The Life and Legacy of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was inarguably one of the most consequential U.S. presidents. He is best remembered for his international vision. After reluctantly leading the nation into World War I, he dreamed and conceived of a new world order, a League of Nations ensuring peace and prosperity. But on the domestic front, his agenda shaped the modern economy. He oversaw the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank, the introduction of the income tax, antitrust legislation, the 8-hour workday, and child labor laws. Like so many leaders in history, Wilson was a complicated man full of contradictions, a man with a strong moral compass, but often a hypocrite. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we will speak with the author of a new book about Woodrow Wilson. We'll also check in with Maine Public's political team, Mal Leary and Steve Missler, about the elections. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Woodrow Wilson believed that the actions of the United States should be aligned with moral principles. His grand vision, a League of Nations, was the culmination of his hopes, but his domestic agenda also reflected his values and shaped the modern economy. Today, we're going to learn about how Wilson came to his beliefs, where his moral blind spots were, and the lessons his presidency offers to current national and international affairs. In the studio with me, author Patricia O'Toole. She is the author of 5 books, including When Trumpets Call, Theodore Roosevelt After the White House, and The 5 of Hearts, an intimate portrait of Henry Adams and his friends, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her new book is The Moralist, Woodrow Wilson and the World He Made. Patricia, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear from you. How familiar are you with the life of Woodrow Wilson? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. But before we talk about Woodrow Wilson, we need to talk a little bit about the elections. Steve Missler and Mal Leary are both here with me after long nights. Steve, I'm going to start with you. The conventional wisdom, not just the conventional wisdom, the wisdom going into yesterday was that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats were going to have someone receive 50% of the vote. There was just no way. But look what Sean Moody has done.
Yeah, I mean, that was, a shock to just about anybody, including perhaps Moody's campaign, which, I mean, I expected the Republican primary to at least get to the tabulation, the ranked choice voting tabulation, at least have a second round. I thought it would get that far. But that didn't happen. I mean, Moody jumped out to an early lead in the early returns and just really never looked back. And, you know, his closest challenger was Garrett Mason, who I thought would do a lot better. I mean, he was considered the dark horse in that primary field. I think everybody felt like he had a lot of momentum. But it just didn't translate into the numbers last night. And Moody was, you know, doing what nobody thought was going to happen, which was making a victory speech.
Why do you think? How did he do it?
I don't know. I mean, I do know that, you know, he had the LePage, Governor Paul LePage's machine behind him, which, you know, I think helped in terms of building a coalition that would support him. He also he checks a lot of boxes that LePage checked back in 2010 when he came out of nowhere.
Now, sure, businessman?
Businessman, exactly. He has no political record, so there's really nothing to hit him with outside of the fact that he was an independent and recently joined the Republican Party. And so in that sense, I mean, we're in an age where it seems as though, at least on the Republican side, there's this hunger for people who are not politicians at all, or who are, even though they're aspiring to be one. And so I think that that's part of it. And I think I just think they ran a pretty good campaign, and he has a lot of name recognition because he's a small business owner and a very successful one. So people know who he is, and that seemed to play a big part in this.
So, Mal, last I saw you, a little after midnight last night, you were really fascinated by some of the numbers in this election year. Tell me what some of the numbers are telling you that make this election so interesting.
Well, let's start off with that Republican primary because it is the most fascinating one. What's interesting to me is far fewer Republican voters came out this time than in 2010 10 when Governor LePage was nominated. I mean significantly. In 2010, the Republican turnout was over 131,000 voters. Right now, we're looking at a Republican turnout of around 85,000 voters.
Mm.
So that's a significant difference. On the Democratic side, they have something to be happy about in that it looks like their turnout this year will closely match the 122,000 that turned out in 2010. So they're at least meeting the same levels of voter interest that they had 8 years ago. But still, if I were running Moody's campaign, I would be a little worried about the enthusiasm factor being so far down in the primary from what it was when Paul LePage won the primary 8 years ago.
What do the numbers tell you, Mal, about the ranked choice voting referendum, the people's veto?
Well, the ranked choice voting folks did exactly what they said they needed to do, and that is they got a lot of unenrolled voters to show up at the polls. And we can say that by looking at the total turnout for folks who were running for governor. Ranked choice voting took, right now, is roughly 250,000 people voted in the ranked choice voting question. When you look at how many people have cast ballots for governor, both Republicans and Democrats, it's still a little under 200,000. That's a big difference. That's a lot of unenrolled voters that the ranked choice voters, ranked choice voting supporters got out to the polls, and I think it made a really big difference to them.
Steve, how influential will this second vote, the second statewide vote, be when the legislature convenes next time? I mean, will there be more momentum to change the Constitution of Maine to make ranked choice voting the law of the land, or do you still expect resistance?
Well, I think in the short term, in terms of legal resistance, I think we'll see a lot less, in part because Republicans have been leading the resistance against ranked choice voting. But here they are, the day after the debut of this landmark law and voting system, with a majority winner. So they're not going to be able to, you know, go out and say, oh, we've been damaged by this process. We produced a majority winner. So I think that's going to preempt any lawsuits that we're planning, that were in the offering in the aftermath of this thing. In terms of how that translates to the legislature, I think if lawmakers are watching these results and they're looking at the numbers that Mal just told you, they should be very cognizant of those numbers. I mean, there was no reason really for independent voters to turn out yesterday because these are primary elections. They can't even vote in the primary contests. The only reason they came out was if they had a local ballot referendum issue to talk about or to vote on, or ranked choice voting. And as Mal just pointed out, they came out, and it looks like they came out for ranked choice voting.
Yeah, Mal, speaking of ranked choice voting, we haven't talked about the Democrats yet, and ranked choice voting will determine the winner. Is there any inside baseball here? Anybody predicting whether Janet Mills or Adam Cody will take those second place votes for the Mark Eaves or the other candidates?
This is really going to be the wild one that we have to watch, because the way the process works is they'll start off by eliminating the lowest vote total person. In this case, it's Donna Dion. She's got around 1,600 votes. But where did her people go on their second choice? That's what ranked choice voting is all about. We have no idea where they're going to go, who they're going to support. And because the numbers are such, Janet Mills is around a 33% in the numbers I've got before me right now, they may have to go through four rounds before we actually get somebody up to the 50% level and is declared the winner under ranked choice. So there's a lot of room for maneuver there, and I think that's why you heard Adam Cody say, you know, it's not over yet, and he's absolutely right, it's not over yet. Until those second, third, and fourth place votes are tallied when they run the computer sometime next week.
I asked Secretary of State Matt Dunlap last week when we would know the final results, and he, as you might remember, didn't tell me, even guess. What do you think? What do you think, Mal? When will we know?
Well, again, from what Matt Dunlap has said, you know, he hopes to have those collected this week so they can put them in the computer on Monday and Tuesday. So he's hoping within, early next week that they'll be able to run. Once all the computer, all the ballots are in the computer and they have all the data present, it's not going to take long to run them. So that's really quick. The problem's getting all these ballots collected from all these communities, getting them put in, because a lot of them are paper ballots, so they're going to have to be scanned into the computer system, as opposed to places like here in Augusta, where they use electronic voting to begin with. So it was a little computer stick that was taken over to the Secretary of State's office to be plugged into the computer.
Well, it's also interesting. Thank you both, Mal and Steve, for joining us for just a little bit today on Maine Calling. And I want to note that tomorrow Mal is going to host the program. His guests will be Speaker of the House Sarah Gideon and President of the Maine Senate Mike Thibodeau. Mal is Maine Public's senior political correspondent, and Steve Missler is Maine Public's chief political correspondent. Basically, it's the A-team in Augusta. Thanks, both of you, for joining us. Now, turning to our author, Patricia O'Toole. And, you know, Patricia, I haven't said this yet in the program, but you are a Maine author. We have such an embarrassment of riches here in Maine, wonderful authors. But you're researching Woodrow Wilson from the Midcoast, aren't you?
I actually was mostly finished with the book by the time I moved here, which was about 2 years ago.
Okay. So, but I'm happy that you're here with me in the studio
and not in a studio somewhere else. I'm very happy to be a Maine author. I love being here.
What made you interested in Woodrow Wilson?
I have a great interest in the period from about 1880 to 1920. I don't know why exactly, if I had a past life in that era. This is my third book in that era. And Wilson was kind of the problem that I hadn't tackled yet, because there's such a mix, as you said in your lead up, of controversy and consequence. So I wanted to get in there and see if I could untangle that knot and figure him out.
Your book, the central theme in the book and the title, The Moralist, really investigates this idea that Woodrow Wilson was guided by a strong internal moral compass, but not all the time. And a New York Times reviewer said this book could have been called The Hypocrite. Is that too harsh?
I think so. Yes, I think so. I thought it was quite a striking way to begin a review, but I think it's too harsh. The places where he was behind on race, for example. The northern liberals who helped him win the White House were very disappointed that he decided to segregate the civil service. He did that not because he had come into office with this secret plan to harm persons of color. He had to get his economic reforms through Congress, the Federal Reserve, a new tax act, a Federal Trade Commission, and so on. And all of those things required a huge expansion of federal authority, which was anathema to Southern congressmen and senators, because they thought if the government does this, the federal government does this in one area, it'll be very easy to do it in others, and it could mean the end of white supremacy and segregation in the South. So they wanted a sign that he wasn't going to do that, and their price was, for going along with these economic reforms, to segregate the civil service. That had been a place where African Americans could get a good job and a lasting job. It was a real way into the middle class, and it had been integrated for decades. So it was a huge setback, and the consequences didn't just end with Woodrow Wilson. This went on through the New Deal. Just about all New Deal economic reforms were passed on the backs of black people. You know, they were left out of certain things. You know, Social Security excluded domestic workers and farm workers, it went on and on until both Democrats and Republicans tolerated this. It wasn't until LBJ came along that we get a real change. So that's a very long time and a big black mark on Woodrow Wilson's record.
So he's an idealist in that he's very upset about the economic conditions of the time. He's upset about the capitalists, the bankers, the plutocrats, and what the economy means for real people. So he's an idealist, but he's also a pragmatist, because he's making this distasteful deal in order to get his agenda passed.
Yes, it was an expedient that he felt he had to adopt. And the interesting thing to me about it was, whenever someone came to the White House to talk to him about this, it didn't happen very often, but minutes were taken of these meetings. And the issue, he was a man who really liked having the moral high ground and worked hard to get there. But when he didn't have it, I think he sensed that he didn't on this issue, and it actually made him physically ill. After the first one of these meetings, he went to bed for days. And another one, he just left town immediately after it was over. So he couldn't think of a way out of this problem. And he said to a group of black leaders who were visiting him to talk about this, this is not going to change until Southern politicians need black votes. And that's exactly what happened with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the 60s. Finally, you know, they had to contend.
So a very sort of clear assessment of reality, even
yes.
if it wasn't the reality that his
yes.
base wanted to hear.
Yes. And it is more shocking to us now. You know, this was well known at the time, and historians have always written about this. But it was only a couple of years ago when the students at Princeton, where Wilson had been a professor and then president, learned of this and made a big protest about it. And that protest, of course, was part of the other protests of taking down statues of Confederate heroes and that sort of thing.
We only just very quickly touched on this economic agenda, though, but it was really significant. I mean, I think, and we will talk about this in a few minutes, that Wilson is most known because of he led us into World War I and he conceived of the League of Nations. But I didn't realize, Patricia, the 8-hour workday, the Federal Reserve Bank, you know, antitrust laws. I mean, these were really big changes in the fabric of how the American economy worked.
Yes, it was a complete overhaul. And he managed to get it through in a very short time. Nobody ever outdid him in terms of significant domestic legislation until FDR and then LBJ. But he's a giant. And we still have all of these things.
And one of them is the federal income tax, which
yes.
folks today might think, how did we come to have a federal income tax? How was that a good and progressive thing? Explain to us why 106 years ago that was a progressive idea.
Well, it was a great income tax. You know, if we want to make America great again, we can go back to the original income tax schedule because the top rate was 7%, and that was paid only by people who earned more than $500,000 a year in 1916. And half the people didn't pay any income tax. So, and what the reason for the income tax and the reason it was an improvement for most people is that before that, the government's principal source of revenue was slapping tariffs on everything that was imported. So that made an awful lot of consumer goods much more expensive. Somebody estimated in around 1912 that it added $1,000 a year to the average household's expenses. So if you were an average household and then this income tax comes along, you're getting lower prices because there aren't any more tariffs or the tariffs are significantly reduced. And then you're probably not having to pay income tax as well. So it was an economic reform that was beneficial to the majority of Americans.
So much to talk about, but I made the mistake of looking at the clock, and I know we have to take our first break. We're talking with Patricia O'Toole, the author of The Moralist, a biography of Woodrow Wilson. What are your questions about Wilson? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet, or post a Facebook post. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems, norrisinc.com, and Mercy Hospital, celebrating 100 years in Greater Portland, partnering with the community to deliver personal and compassionate care, mercyhospital.org.
I'm Tim Franks. News doesn't just happen Monday through Friday. BBC News Hour is here to keep you up to date across the world.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
Give us some more detail of what's been announced.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. You will, everybody will.
Again, another huge development.
Stay connected. Tune in to BBC News Hour.
BBC News Hour weekday mornings at 9 o'clock and weekend afternoons at 4 o'clock.
On the next Fresh Air, the tradition of black athletes taking a stand, Journalist Howard Bryant's new book, The Heritage, traces athletes' political and social advocacy back to Jackie Robinson, Bill Russell, Muhammad Ali, and others. He'll tell us why athlete activism disappeared, how it came back, and was complicated by the patriotism of the post-9/11 era. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how the presidency of Woodrow Wilson may offer insights into the debate over so many things today. Joining me, author Patricia O'Toole. Her new book is The Moralist, Woodrow Wilson and the World He Made. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Patricia, it was so interesting to be reading this book during an election season and in so many ways. And one of the things that really struck me is how different things used to be. The fact that Woodrow Wilson was kind of chosen to be the candidate for governor and chosen to be the candidate for president. It was very different, wasn't it?
Yes, the bosses were fully in charge in a way that I don't think they are so much anymore. There were many fewer primaries, for one thing. The election of 1912 is the first time that there was a significant number. I think there were 12. But mostly the candidates were chosen in state caucuses, and the bosses got together and told the herd what to do. So in 1912, Theodore Roosevelt ran as a third-party candidate, and he was up against the Republican machine. So he won all the primaries, actually. That was 12 states. There were 48 states. So Taft's people had everything sewn up in the other 36 states. So there was no way when Roosevelt, he was trying first to get the Republican nomination, but he couldn't get it because of the Republican machine.
Well, and there was a big move to create more primaries instead of having state legislatures vote, right? Because, again, looked at as a progressive idea, but one of those that ended up having some unintended consequences.
Yes. I mean, it makes the election season go on forever, and it's horrendously expensive. Yeah.
Woodrow Wilson is an unlikely candidate, was then, by today's standards, entirely unlikely. When's the last time we had a college professor or president?
Obama taught law.
Oh, that's true.
For
he
a
did
little
teach
bit,
law.
But, yes, but it's
Before
a rare
was,
thing.
Yes.
It's a very rare thing. And yes, and Wilson, I mean, he resembles in some ways Jimmy Carter. You know, Jimmy Carter kind of came out of nowhere from being governor of Georgia. It was a time when, you know, it was right after Watergate. So he was a nice, clean, moral progressive. So they're very similar in that way. And he had a great deal of appeal on account of that. And Wilson as well. People were sick and tired of the plutocrats. And, you know, there's a huge inequality problem. Probably, I don't know whether it was worse than it is now, but it was huge and it was getting bigger. And a lot, there had been building resentment about that for 12 years at least. So quite a lot of similarity there. Wilson was, although he was, you might say, cloistered, he's off at Princeton being a professor and then the president of Princeton. And governor of New Jersey for only 2 years before he becomes president. But when he was a professor at Princeton and the president of the university, he had quite a high profile as what we might call a public intellectual. He wrote a lot. He spoke a lot. He was the most fantastic speaker of his time, so he was in great demand to do that. So the kind of educated, more liberal element of society and the kind of liberal wing of the press, all those people knew him, but he was just kind of unknown to the general population.
Okay. There's so many great characters in the book, but one that I have been, in the chapters I'm in and somebody I've been thinking about a lot is Colonel House. And, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but tell me about Colonel House.
Colonel House is an interesting figure. I don't know that we've had anybody else like him. Presidents often have confidential advisors, and that's what House was. House was a very rich Texan, And he liked politics, but as a young man, he had been out in the sun and got sunstroke, and he was sensitive to heat and kind of a physically fragile individual. But he was a very personable man, and he lived in Texas, and he helped four Democratic governors get elected. He kind of learned about politics that way. And then he wanted to move up and find a Democratic presidential candidate. But William Jennings Bryan, who was a bombastic speaker, a very religious kind of person, and some people thought not very deep, intellectually deep. A reporter of the time said, "I love every bone in his head." And he got the Democratic nomination three times, and House didn't want to back him. So House is just biding his time. He's studying history. He's learning about politics. He's busy networking with everybody in the Democratic establishment with the idea that someday perhaps he can be a kingmaker. So Wilson comes along. He likes Wilson. He decides to throw in his chips with Wilson. And he didn't play much of a role in the campaign because he was ill, but he had huge influence in selecting the cabinet. And then after that, he was somewhat interested in domestic affairs, but once he had a taste of foreign affairs, he happened to be in Europe right before World War I began, and it was the sense of the war coming was in the air, and he would have loved to be the guy who stopped it. But then he got a taste of foreign affairs, and it was like champagne to him. You know, he wanted to taste every variety and have it all the time. So Wilson, presidents in those days could not travel easily to other continents. So Wilson entrusted these missions to him and didn't really even give him very much in the way of instruction.
Though he did tell him some things not to do.
He did tell him some things not to do, yes. And House just kind of, he was someone, people liked him and he could see that people liked him. And he just thought that if there's a difference between what Wilson thinks and what some British politicians were thinking, that somehow House will be able to finesse it and make it all come out right. So in the end, Wilson and House broke up over House basically overstepping, and this was at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, and telling people, "Don't worry, I will handle it with Wilson." And also, it was hard to see Wilson. So House was always available to be seen by the press, and the press got the idea that he was running the whole show in Princeton, in Paris, and that did not sit well with Wilson.
So at several points in their relationship, House went, today the phrase might be, he was going rogue. He was
yes.
telling Wilson one thing and doing something
yes.
else.
Yes.
And I think about that as I watch the news today. And, and maybe this has been the case in every presidential cabinet, but it seems more apparent now, the differences in what different people in President Trump's cabinet think and want when it has, when it comes to the G7 or North Korea.
Yes. And then there is the president himself who changes from day to day. So it's quite a different situation.
We'll go to Colin, who's calling from Berwick. Hi, Colin. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I haven't had an opportunity to read the book yet, and I'm hoping that my history lessons of the past are serving me correctly. But is it my recollection that as Woodrow Wilson sort of aged and experienced health problems, that his wife actually stepped in and sort of did some of his presidential duties on the sly? And if so, isn't it sort of duly hypocritical that Wilson was himself a little behind the times on women's rights? I might totally be recalling this wrong from, my high school or college studies, but I was just wondering if you could maybe comment on that a little bit.
Collins, it's a great question.
His wife was even more behind the times on women's suffrage than he was, if you can believe it. She didn't think women should vote at all. And Wilson's position on it was that he thought that women should vote, but the states should decide rather than having a constitutional amendment. And it had taken a very long time for a handful of states to enact women's suffrage. So at a certain point, there was a critical mass of women pushing for a constitutional amendment. And where Wilson was behind, he was slow to support the constitutional amendment. He finally did it when he saw it was going to happen anyway. He finally did it. But this business about Mrs. Wilson being kind of acting as president when he was felled by a stroke, I see her as not a president or an acting president, but as a gatekeeper. He could not really do very much. He could have a conversation with you that would lead you to think that there was no impairment in his cognitive functions. But he couldn't sustain his concentration, and he couldn't read anymore because the stroke he was blind in one eye and had lost lost half the vision in the other eye. So reading was impossible. He should not have been president, but his doctor was in a terrible position. His doctor, his loyalty is to his patient, right? But he's also the doctor, an admiral in the U.S. Navy, so he's sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution. And there was a way to remove the president from office. It had never been done. But he has this idea, and another of the specialists who came to consult Wilson had the idea that it would be bad for Wilson, perhaps even fatal, to tell him that he couldn't be president anymore, that it was a great incentive for him to get well if he were told that, yes, you know, you can function in this way and you will be better, you will get better all the time. And he did make some progress in getting better, but really fairly minimal. It was a huge cover-up. And the way Mrs. Wilson functioned, if you were a cabinet secretary and you had a question for the president, you could send it to him, and you had to phrase it in a way, spell out the issues, and then phrase it in a way where he could make a yes or no decision. So that's kind of limiting if it's a complicated issue. And then Mrs. Wilson would decide to show it to him or not to show it to him or when to show it to him, because he had good days and bad days. So that's the role that she played.
Colin, thanks for your question. You talk about the debilitating stroke toward the ends of his presidency, but Wilson struggled with very serious health issues all along.
Yes, as a young man, he had a stroke. He had a series of minor strokes at different points in his life, and this was not people's medical conditions were not disclosed when they ran for president. That's a good change that we've made. People who have big strokes often have a series of small strokes, and you just never know if there's going to be a big one or when the big one is going to come. He was totally exhausted at the point he had this stroke. He was out. He had been out traveling the country, a 10,000-mile tour, ginning up support for the League of Nations. The Senate was then controlled by Republicans, and they didn't want the League of Nations without certain compromises in it. So Wilson totally exhausted himself, collapsed on this tour, came home, and then had this major stroke.
All right. Well, we do have to take another break. I want to talk a little bit more about the idea of the League of Nations and where we are today because of Wilson's vision. But we do have to take another quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Camden National Wealth Management, providing trust services to clients throughout Maine, New England, and beyond. CamdenNational.com and the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public.
A former North Korean nuclear inspector says this time could be different.
There's a chance for the new start, but the question is North Korea now going to bite the bullet and implement its share?
I'm Audie Cornish. What it would actually take to get rid of North Korea's nuclear program, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio.
Parliamentary elections in Iraq this past May not only set a new course for that country, they also set a new course for the United States.
Mukhtar hates the United States. That's going to be a problem. And we're going to have to figure out how do we relate to someone who has defined himself by his enmity toward the United States.
A look at Iraq's future and what's at stake for greater peace and stability next time on America Abroad.
That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, looking back at President Woodrow Wilson and why he remains relevant. Joining me today, Patricia O'Toole. Her book, The Five of Hearts, An Intimate Portrait of Henry Adams and His Friends, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circles Award, and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Her new book is The Moralist, Woodrow Wilson and the World He Made. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Patricia O'Toole, long before Woodrow Wilson campaigned for and conceived of the League of Nations, he had this idea, this big idea, that the world needed to have some sort of uniting body and that all nations needed to be considered equal. How radical an idea was that?
There had been other ideas, poems written on the subject, philosophers writing about the subject, but Wilson was the first one to bring it to fruition. And he started thinking about it as soon as the war broke out in 1914. He wanted to know, well, what exactly caused it? And his list of things included several things: nationalism, intense nationalism with rivalry between nations, and then the militarism, you know, the military buildups that happened, which were enormous in the years before World War I. And then the thing that he disliked the most and thought that he could change with the League of Nations was these alliances, which meant, you know, if you had an alliance and I had an alliance and one of your countries got attacked, then you would have to, like, everybody in the alliance would have to go to war over that.
World War One.
World War One. Yes. So that's how World War One became a world war almost overnight, because you had like 16 countries, I think, in the beginning, all the great nations of Europe virtually involved at war. So he thought, what would happen if you brought the whole world together in a single alliance? Then they couldn't do that. And this alliance was to be the first. There had been international organizations before, but there'd never been an international association of governments that was going to aim to be global and have as its primary purpose a commitment to peace. They had a whole lot of steps they could take if somebody were an international aggressor. They could push back in a variety of ways before they actually went to war. And then the troops going to war would be a collective force, which became a huge bone of contention. But that was the idea, that if you brought all nations together in an organization committed to peace, you maybe wouldn't prevent all wars, but you could go a long way toward preventing most of them.
And the U.S. Senate did not pass his
resolution. What happened, I mean, here we are in 2018, talking about midterm elections incessantly. We started off with what's happening in Maine. And in 1918, that was a hugely important election because for the first 6 years of his presidency, Wilson had a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate. And he lost that in 1918. And it happens at about the same moment that the armistice happens. It's November 1918. So you'd think he'd be all jubilant about the end of the war, but he now has this huge problem because he's not going to be in control of the House and the Senate. And his reaction to it was one of defiance. It was, well, the president is the only official who's elected by all the people, and I'm going to be here for another 21 months. I'm going off to negotiate this peace treaty. You know, the United States Senate has always ratified peace treaties. Therefore, this is going to be okay, is what he was telling himself. But he came home with the treaty, and there were a lot of people, mostly Republicans, who thought that it spelled endless entanglement in European conflicts. And so they offered him a compromise on several points, and he would not do it. He just would not do it. And I think he was a stubborn guy, that's for sure. And when a stubborn guy wins, we call that determination, right? But when a stubborn guy loses, I mean, Americans hate failure. They just absolutely hate failure in politics. So he went out of office kind of a defeated and, you know, people thought it was absurd what he did. And it's possible that the stroke figured in his rigidity. He was sidelined. He couldn't lead the fight in the Senate after his stroke. It's possible that he could have done a little better, but the lines were pretty clearly drawn.
Before we get to a couple more calls, I want to ask you, if Woodrow Wilson could look forward in a crystal ball 100 years, here we are, you know, with the United Nations, NATO, the IMF, all these other international organizations, what do you think would have been his thinking about that?
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way, because in 1918, he had a senator in his office, and it was just at the time the war was ending, and he was thinking about the peace, and he said, I am playing for 100 years hence. So here we are, exactly 100 years hence. And the League of Nations fell apart. There was no will to – the United States never joined because the Senate did not in the end ratify the treaty that contained the League of Nations covenant. And then there was no will in the 1930s to kind of enforce the take action against Hitler when he began his aggressions in Europe. So we get another world war. And FDR, some people think that FDR was kind of the heir to Wilson. I think that other people have argued that, no, he threw out the whole, everything Wilson did and started over, created a whole new thing. But FDR, I see the United Nations as like Wilson 2.0. Because FDR had been the Assistant Secretary of the Navy in Wilson's administration, watched the whole thing, was clearly a man of great political ambition himself. He's watching what Wilson does and thinking about whether it's working or not working. And so he's had years and years to think about how you do something like this. And from the beginning, he got bipartisan support for the UN, which Wilson hadn't done. Wilson was just determined to cram it down the throats of the Senate. And he also realized that too great a burden had been put on the League of Nations to expect, you know, one organization to do everything. So when the UN came along, there were these kind of collateral institutions, some of them global and some of them regional. And you mentioned a couple of them, the World Bank, the IMF, NATO, so that you're spreading responsibility around for various things. He understood, FDR understood, that things would go better for the United States. And since the United States was not really out to expand its territory, didn't have an empire, you know, FDR thought the United States could do a good job as a world leader and in a kind of benign way. It hasn't worked out that way. I mean, there's lots to criticize about U.S. foreign policy. But FDR was a committed internationalist, as Wilson was. So now we're at the end of it. You know, that system is falling apart. We have the rise of these strongmen and various, it's not only in the United States that we have this hyper kind of nationalism. We have the rise of these strongmen and, you know, attacks on the press and that sort of thing. So this is where we are, 100 years from Wilson. And the only thing, what I think about is, that you can't go it alone, you know. Wilson saw that global problems require global solutions. So anybody who thinks they can go it alone or, you know, all right, we can pull out of a climate accord, but climate change is not going to go away. It's going to happen whether we're part of this or not.
We're going to go to Bob calling from Chibig Island. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, how are you? 2 points about the League of Nations and Wilson's attitudes and so forth. He was a virulent anti-Semite, and he also was a segregationist. So did he just completely ignore Eastern Europe and Africa in his plans, or was there some all-encompassing point of view?
Actually, I take issue with you on the anti-Semitism. He appointed Brandeis to the Supreme Court, you know, the first Jewish justice.
Yeah, but that's the exception. That's the example that proves the rule.
No, there. Honestly, there is no anti-Semitism, and you can read his papers from volume 1 to 69, and there's no anti-Semitism there. I'm sorry. But on the Wilson was mostly concerned about what was going to happen in Europe, and there were a lot of arrangements made in the Treaty of Versailles by the imperial powers affecting Africa and the Middle East and Asia to a degree. And Wilson, it's not that he didn't care about those things, but there's a question of where to put his emphasis, and he was mainly concerned about getting some new democracies up and running in Europe.
Bob, thanks for your call. An email from Nancy. Patricia said most of her research was complete by the time she moved to Maine 2 years ago, but I'm curious to know, where did she do that research? Was there a single archive that was the most significant, or did she have to do a lot of digging and poking in lots of different places? And here's the best question. Was there any single thing she unturned that was especially surprising?
What a great question, Nancy. There's no single archive. The largest archives are at Princeton, and it's not just Wilson's papers there, but papers of a lot of his associates, and then the Library of Congress. So I spent months and months at each of those places. I also went to the French Diplomatic Archives and the British National Archives, and down to Stanton, Virginia, his birthplace, where there's a library with a lot of family papers and other things. And the most surprising, two surprising things, actually. One is, we were talking about it earlier, that when he didn't have the moral, when he knew he didn't have the moral high ground, he was actually physically ill, which no one had ever pointed out before. I mean, it's not, it's one of those things like gravity existed before Isaac Newton discovered it, but, you know, we give Newton credit for discovering the laws of gravity. So this record of his illness and was there, but people hadn't really thought about what these illnesses might be in response to. So that was one new thing. And the other new thing was kind of inadvertent. It wasn't a kind of research I meant to do, but I got very sick one summer while I was writing the book, and I couldn't think straight, and I didn't know I was sick. And it turned out I needed a pacemaker. And the second the pacemaker was hooked up, I could think straight again. So it gave me an insight into Wilson and his strokes and his circulatory troubles that, you know, when your pump isn't working, you honestly can't think straight. You can function well enough to go to the grocery store and have an interesting conversation, but to do any sort of high order of task, you can't. So that was an invaluable experience for writing about Wilson, but I don't recommend it as a research technique.
But isn't that interesting? And when you think as a historian of the decisions of consequence he was having to make at a time when he was physically compromised and possibly mentally compromised.
Well, you certainly are mentally compromised. You just can't do the higher order things like concentrate in a sustained way. And, you know, most of the time we can multitask and we don't have to concentrate in a sustained way. But he couldn't read. He couldn't see well enough to read. And he couldn't write except for, you know, a line or two. And yet, the curious thing when this is going on in your head, you don't know how impaired you are. You think you're fine. So he's lying flat on his back in the White House in 1919, shading into 1920, and he's imagining that he's going to run for president in 1920. And then when he leaves the White House, he's still very compromised. He's somewhat physically stronger, and he's more or less accepted his situation that he's not going to get any better than he is in, say, 1922. But what he's doing, like just a few weeks before he dies, he's imagining he's going to get the presidential nomination in 1924. And he's outlining his acceptance speech and his inaugural speech. So there's just a disconnect.
It's just fascinating. Well, Patricia, thanks so much for joining us today. An hour doesn't seem like enough time. Patricia O'Toole is the author of 5 books and her new book we've been discussing today, The Moralist, Woodrow Wilson and the World He Made. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Legislative Leadership. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.